My name is Michelle Bellorti, and I am an outreach and recruitment specialist at the Institute of International Education, and I'm based in our Washington, D.C. office. And I'm joined by Dr. Catherine Heinlein. She's an associate professor at Azusa Pacific University, and she's a recently returned alum. She also is the associate director of the Neighborhood Wellness Center at Azusa. And Dr. Heinlein was a teaching and research grantee to India from December 2017 to June 2018 at Calcutta Mercy Hospital in West Bengal. So without further ado, I want to first, before we have Catherine join us on the phone, I want to first go over some of the opportunities available in India. This is specifically focused on the awards available for U.S. citizens who are academics, professionals, who are interested in researching and teaching in India. And we do have three awards available to India with over 50 grants. In other words, these three awards to India have over 50, about 50 spots available. So that's exciting. And again, the opportunities are available to teach research or do a combination of teaching and research. There are a variety of eligible host institutions. You'll notice in the award descriptions that the awards to India do say any appropriate institution, whether it's a university, an NGO, a research center, a think tank, a ministry, etc. So there's a lot of flexibility and leeway in selecting an appropriate institution in India. And also, we'll be getting to a little more detail about this later, but the Fulbright program is administered in India through the Fulbright Commission. It's a bilateral entity established. It's been in India for over 50 years, and it's in Delhi, in New Delhi. And so we at IIE work very closely with the Fulbright Commission in India to determine, you know, what awards there will be and how to, you know, find the best applicants for those. And also once grantees are selected and they arrive in India, the commission works very closely with grantees to help them get placed and et cetera. So you'll be hearing us mention the commission or the Fulbright Commission. So just want to let you know that it's a binational entity. That works very closely with us at IIE, as well as the State Department's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. So you'll see the three logos at the bottom of our slides. So those are the three kind of main entities, stakeholders that are working to make this program float. Now, as many of you know, India is a very large country, and we always hear about being the world's largest democracy. It's so much more. It's in a way kind of defies categorization. It's home to almost every major religion in the world, very diverse in and of itself, and, you know, engaging with, you know, becoming increasingly globally connected while at the same time respecting traditions and culture. So it's a very dynamic country to be in. It's a very rich country historically, linguistically, culturally, and also geographically. So lots of different opportunities available in India. And so that's what today's webinar is going to focus on and showcase, as well as showcasing Dr. Heinlein's experience and a little bit of information about her project and some advice. She'll be taking questions from you live, so be prepared with your questions. And as you can see in this picture, it's a picture of Dr. Heinlein with her group of students and faculty that she worked with, and she'll be able to speak more to that. So let's continue. All right, so I'd like to bring on Dr. Heinlein. Are you on the call?
I am.
Wonderful. Yes. So I'm going to pass it over to you and let you describe a little bit about your project, how you came about, you know, selecting India, and kind of sharing some insights before we go into some of the awards available.
Okay. I'm just delighted to be on this call. And a little bit about my project. I have been going to Kolkata since 2008 in the summer with my own nursing students for a short-term cultural, educational, medical missions experience. And the first year I was there, I want to say that it was a big adjustment, but I returned the following year and have been going to this place, Kolkata, ever since. So here we are in 2018. I'm going again in the summer of 19, a solo trip. But back to the question at hand, my observation and learning curve was to find that India was a major country with major numbers of persons with diabetes. And I was very, you know, perplexed about that, because in my mind I thought, here is a place, India, where in my mind assumptions are that these individuals don't have a lot of food, they are malnourished. I could hardly think that they would have type 2 diabetes, which is the major problem that's relative to obesity. So I was perplexed, and that's kind of what generated my interest in this field. I'm a certified diabetes educator, and that's what I do. My practice is diabetes prevention, diabetes education. So I wanted to do something while I was going back and forth there. So my project was to work with nursing students before they graduated from their general nurse midwifery program, to train them, experiential training, train the trainer model is what I used, to bring them up to a place where they actually could run their own diabetes prevention program. So that was my project, and I had 48 students, nursing students. They were second year, and took them through a training program and brought them to a place where they were able to increase their knowledge about diabetes and their self-confidence about establishing a program in their community, and also their self-efficacy and how they felt about the community after they learned about the plight of those persons with diabetes. So that's kind of it in a nutshell, and I will continue to return there just to facilitate and be a mentor to this hospital's nursing program.
Great. Thank you, Catherine, for sharing about that. So can you tell us when you were putting together, because most of the people on the webinar are in the process of putting their application together, considering their options, whether India might be a good choice or, you know, elsewhere. So what were some of the things you did in your application or in the run-up, you know, in terms of a letter of invitation and a little bit about the project statement?
Mm-hmm. Great question. Thank you. So first I had to connect with the hospital to see if this would be something they would be interested in having me do. So I had made a visit to talk to the medical director there. So first, getting an idea if this was even a possibility from the establishment in which I wanted to do it. In terms of the project proposal that needed to go to the USIEF, luckily I had some background. Of course, I had the passion. I put together my proposal looking at, my research, literature review, to also infuse into that project proposal and talk about my passion for this very issue. diabetes prevention. So my proposal, I went away through the university on a writer's retreat. And what that means is that I have 3 to 4 days with other writers at the university away from campus, where you're pretty much isolated to think and write. And that is exactly what I did, because I wanted that proposal to be not only succinct, because it is, it's a 5-page in terms of what you're going to put into it, and they mean that. So to be succinct, to get maybe some feedback from mentors that were at the writer's retreat, so I had to really pour my heart into it. And I was followed up with a phone call after that. Again, so the person on the other line from USIEF also wanted to talk to me about, again, hearing my passion about it. So I would say, if there's something you're passionate about, write succinctly to that, have done your research about the area that you are interested in terms of if it's teaching or research or a combination of both, because that is what I did. Mine was a teaching and research award that I was given. Talk to your passion. Talk to the fact that, the humility that you really want to do something about your observation or whatever your expertise is in. You want to move into something that shows them that you have this heart and passion for this population.
Great, thank you. And just to clarify, what was the ratio of teaching to research? And did you discuss that? How did you come about determining that ratio?
Well, because I'm a diabetes educator, and I knew that I was going to be educating nursing students, I selected a 20% research, 80% education. That was what I had selected, but I think we've talked, and I'm doing a little bit more research on the back end now. But that's what I went into with my proposal.
Great, thank you. And could you tell us a little bit about the teaching experience that you had? The kind of students you had, and maybe some of the challenges that you didn't anticipate or anything. We often tell applicants to build into their project statement the flexibility and mention their adaptability, et cetera, maybe have a plan B in their back pocket. So if you could speak to that.
Sure. So, yes, I had all those. I went in with a change theory model, if you will, about how I, with that passion, this is what I see happening, which was good. But when I was there, things did get changed around because, again, I'm working with nursing students, and that could be the same if you're working with students or other, community members. What you think your schedule should look like or would look like is not necessarily what their schedule is going to allow. So again, nursing students are in school, and I had to work around their nursing courses and their nursing exams and their community involvement off campus. So I was given 48 nursing students, but I could not have them all at once. Actually, I went into this project with the agreement with the hospital that I would only have 20 nursing students. So I was feeling really good about that, how I was going to work with smaller groups, and this was all going to be great. But again, when I got there, no, you're going to have 48 nursing students. So the School of Nursing worked with me because they know the schedule of the students. Those 48 students were split into 3 groups of 16. And rather than my understanding of having them 8 hours a week, that changed up quite a bit. I might have them for an hour a day for 3 weeks, or an hour a day for 5 weeks, depending on what their schedules were. And one group, I actually had to travel by Uber about an hour out to meet them where they were at after their clinical experience on a Marine base. So here I had to travel an hour out to bring all of my gear and teaching tools out to, and the class was in the kitchen at their dormitory, and then take all that gear back with me to where I was living. So there's just a little bit, but I have other things I could share depending on some of your other questions, Michelle.
Great. Now that sounds, that's exactly, points to the direction of really being prepared and expecting the unexpected.
Yes.
So, Catherine, in terms of your research, now it was only 20% of the grant. What did that entail? Did you need special access to any, were you dealing with any government officials or data, or can you just kind of share a little bit about how that came about?
Sure. So, again, it's what we were, the IRB on our end, the University Institutional Review Board, the affiliation agreement with the hospital and the School of Nursing, so that was an agreement. The students had to I had to go through the consent form. These students, they are taught in their program English, but making sure they understood the consent, that took a little bit of time, plus their demographic form. So gathering that information before we went through the teaching component. But in terms of government restrictions, there weren't any government restrictions except, of course, I only could work with this institution. That was the agreement when I went into register, that I would not be working with any other institution, just within the containment of the agreed-upon institution. But I had my Excel spreadsheet to collect data. I was collecting data and inputted that into Excel spreadsheets. I did have a research colleague, who was my co-principal investigator at my university that I was working with, so she could input that into SPSS24. Not to say that there wasn't somebody helping me back at home, because I was doing the groundwork, which was time-consuming, and then sending her my rough statistics, so she had enough information to put it in the to do the analysis.
Okay, great. And just sorry, going back to the teaching portion, I had another question. Mm-hmm. That I think the audience would be interested in, and that was, did you have to adapt your teaching style, and if so, how? What was that like? And any other kind of things that you did to prepare to teach this, students of nursing in India?
I love the question, and if you could see me, I'm almost laughing. But anyway, yes. So in answer to your question, did I have to change the curriculum that I went over there with? Absolutely. So I used the American Association of Diabetes Educators handbook. So this is our standards of care and on how to educate patients who are going through the learning curve about diabetes, but the students also, I wanted them to understand from the patient perspective what we as educators were going to be asking them to do and what they would have to perform. So these are some of the entities that these nursing students, again, second year, general nurse midwifery program, weren't necessarily abreast of. So I would have to basically go in and, okay, that didn't work. So basically the first group was kind of a trial and making adjustments to the curriculum on the way. And then when I had the second group, adjusting again, and the third group, adjusting again. More often than not, even though I will say students generally, at least in this particular program, are used to the lecturer giving all the information, not a word from the audience. But this is an interactive because they are going to be engaging patients. So this was a full learning curve that they weren't necessarily accustomed to, and I needed them to actually engage and be hands-on. So many adjustments, and I think over time being there, so they learned to trust and they understood that this is all about caring for the patient, so we need to care as a team. I can't tell you how many adjustments I had to make, and then encourage them to be free to talk with their faculty, the investigator. It's okay. We can talk because that's the only way we're going to move forward in this type of experiential training model. So, yes, many adjustments, adjustments after adjustments, and this was a total work in humility and flexibility and patience.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. So now on the flip side, when you came back to California, you were back at your university, how did that experience in India, you know, kind of impact you in the classroom where you are now and just kind of speaking to, you know, how you share that experience with your students?
That's a great question. So coming back, and I will say that, you know, I'm still adjusting, making adjustments as I, it's been a year since I've been there when I arrived there. But I would say I think the biggest benefit, it was the lesson in humility. And I think I could speak to the audience about this. I think this whole project, this ethnographic experience, allowed me to slow down, but I mean in a good way. I mean, I'm full bore, you know, I do have a lot of energy, and I have a kind of this focus, this is the way it's supposed to be. But what I had to learn was to draw back and let these students actually and their faculty be the educators, if you will. So coming back to the university, I'm still talking about it. I'm disseminating the information. Tomorrow we have our research symposium here on campus. I have two posters to present, one on the service learning component of my study and the other on the quantitative analysis of my project. And I can say that I'm still learning, and to take to the university, I would encourage anyone to apply for a Fulbright because it's a lesson in learning that we don't have all the answers, and we seek those answers. We want to do more research and, okay, now I know more about this area. Not enough, but I'm driven to return to this area because that's how important it is to me.
Great, wonderful insights. So, Catherine, at this point, I wanted to turn it over to the questions that we've been getting from the audience. And one was, how did your university deal with you being gone for that semester? So I know we usually advise applicants, you know, speak to your university ahead of time. It's kind of a case-by-case basis. But if you could share a little bit about that.
Great question. First, the whole impetus of me even applying for a Fulbright came from my department dean. She actually suggested that I apply for a Fulbright since I'm over in India with my own students pretty frequently. Two, I was able to square away a sabbatical leave. That was the arrangement. A sabbatical was a semester period. I had applied for 6 months, however, and a sabbatical is a semester about 4 months. But my administrator, since I don't take vacation, I had quite a bit of vacation left, which I banked toward the additional weeks that I would be in India. So that's how that worked. And again, it was an encouragement from my own dean. So that's how that worked. So sabbatical leave plus getting a little bit more time because I could take that time because I had that vacation time that I had not used yet.
Great. So I think you got really lucky because I hear sometimes stories of applicants who get selected and then they have to deal with all of the paperwork and kind of bureaucracy at their institution. So it's helpful when your department, when your campus is supportive. So certainly I would advise applicants if they don't have that support from the outset, you know, or the encouragement to discuss with their dean or their chair or whoever it is that they would need to kind of get some initial clearance or, you know, because you wouldn't want to have a surprise at the end and then have to turn down a grant if you were selected.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay, so let's take a look at the next question. And just to make an announcement in general, we got a question early on in the session about this webinar being available. So we are recording this webinar. And so all of the information in terms of, in the next slide, there's information about the award opportunities and links. So that this will be available on our website in the webinar section in the archive. It'll be posted next week, so you can check back and you can access the webinar then. All right, so let's take a look. Okay. All right. What kinds of commitments do host institutions need to make for Fulbright in terms of, i.e., monetary, academic, et cetera? And the context that's given is a new host, which is a government agency, will be hosting a Fulbrighter for the first time and wants to know. Okay, well, that's interesting. Maybe you can share what Calcutta Mercy Hospital had, you know, kind of promised, whether it was an office space or housing or what have you.
Okay, good question. So I know it will vary depending on where you go. I'm sometimes it helps to be ignorant. So I'm going to just kind of preface it what I'm going to say with that. Because of the affiliation agreement, interestingly on that, I was told that I would be given an office. Office, a desk. I wasn't clear that I was going to have internet access in that office. But those were some things that the agreement was signed. So let me go back to that. I didn't know, I just asked about the internet access, and so the IMT guy at the institution and the printer. So I had to purchase my own printer. But anyway, internet access, I did get it. And so that was set. I think that's it. I mean, of course, I had to purchase my own supplies. That's what the Fulbright is about, too. And then any additionals that weren't covered by Fulbright, you know. So I was going off campus a lot to make volumes of copies because I wasn't allowed to make a lot of copies at their school because that's their equipment, and that was not on the agreement. So no problem, because to make copies for my students' handouts and other things, also incentives. They like prizes. So when we're working together, I had to go out many times to buy little trinkets or prizes. That was on me. And again, additional printing because I didn't want to overtax their resources, which you just kind of get a vibe what would be okay. And then, but if you ask, you know, either the yay or nay. But you know, I had to play a little ignorant on some of this. But they're very hospitable, at least my group, the people I work with, hospitable. And I never felt like I overstepped my boundaries in any way on that.
Great. And speaking of that, kind of going off, piggybacking off of that point about using, having a set aside little budget to make Xeroxes and copies and things like that, we have a few questions about the stipend. So now I know that each university, works it out differently, but if you were on your sabbatical, the question is, were you still receiving your salary in addition to the Fulbright stipend, or did your university make any adjustment, or if you could maybe speak about that?
Okay, sure. My university, I was still getting my salary. So I don't know that that's the case with everyone. Because again, you're leaving home. You still have your mortgage and all that. So, and I think that our university too, we have a strong Fulbright, department here at the university. So I think there's something to that. It's an understanding. But yes, I was receiving my full salary, and again, plus that vacation time, again, I told you about, that was, it just ended up working out. On top of that, though, I used the full amount of my Fulbright stipend because I brought a lot of equipment there with me and had to make purchases while there. Because remember, I thought I was going over there with only 20 participants in my study and ended up, having double that. Yeah.
Well, great. I think that it's very helpful to have a university that's supportive and has, kind of Fulbright-friendly policies. So I would encourage all applicants to, if you're based at a university or college, to check in with the international office or the research and fellowships office. You might have a scholar liaison identified at your campus. You can always reach out to me. I'll provide my contact information, but it's also listed in the awards for India. But certainly having the buy-in from your home institution is very important. We have a couple questions that I'll answer. They're about the flex option. And so the flex option is available for a couple of the awards, and that allows you to carry out research, and it's only available to research projects. It allows you to carry out the research projects over two segments, perhaps maybe three, but two of the plane tickets would be covered, from my understanding, and this can be carried out over two academic years. So that might be a good option for people whose projects lend themselves to doing maybe an initial visit and then collecting more data on the second visit. And the parameters for the flex option are outlined in the award description for the Fulbright-Nehru Academic and Professional Excellence Award, as well as the Cullum Climate Fellowship. So thank you for those questions about flex. And when you do propose the flex option in your project proposal, please be sure to include a timeline of how that, what you envision to do on your first visit and on the second visit and how that all would work out. So giving as much detail as possible. Great. So we had another question Is there a preference for having a single host institution, or could there be multiple host institutions? Now, Catherine, you mentioned in your, was it in your visa also that it was mentioned that you were affiliated with that particular hospital and that hospital only, and when you went to the FRRO, the Foreign Regional Registration Office, you also had to confirm you were only affiliated with them?
That is correct. I want to add to that, though, the American Center, I was asked to give workshops to another organization, and that was okay because I wasn't working for or with them. It was more an invitation. And the students that are on this call now, or faculty, students at faculty, they might be invited to, since you're the expert, you might be invited to do workshops outside of the organization in which you are affiliated, and that's an invitation as a guest speaker because that's your expertise, and that was not something that I was not able to do, but again, my permanent base was the hospital that I was affiliated with.
Yeah, and I did, last year when I did this webinar, the other alum had, her home base was, I believe it was Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi, but a lot of her research required her visiting the archives. So in the visa, that was her home base. The university was her home base, and she was collaborating with faculty there to do her research project, but she also visited the archives frequently and had access to that as well. So I think for the purpose of the visa, you do need to clearly state that you'll be based in one place, and certainly that's all that's that's what's required for the visa. For the application itself, you may submit more than one letter of invitation. If it all fits into the project, you need to be here, but you're also going to access things there. That certainly speaks to the feasibility of the project, but when it comes down to the visa, and I think for the registration purposes, if you're staying longer than, certainly if you're on a Fulbright visa, you would need to register in any case with the Regional Foreign Registration Office, known as the FRRO. But let's kind of go into, we have a question about, and I will be, just for those questions about the competitive, how to put together a competitive application and what specific projects India is interested. I'm going to speak to that shortly, but while we've got Catherine on the phone still, I wanted to ask, someone has asked, how did you find your apartment and what were the amenities like where you lived? Tell us about, kind of the day-to-day, how you maybe got banking sorted out and shopping, and how maybe the Fulbright Commission assisted or not in that, and if they offered any assistance.
Sure. The Fulbright gives you, they will put you up in a hotel, at least this was for me, for the first week until you find lodging. But I want to say that I had already have been to this place, and I found an inexpensive place in which to live, a room with a, it's almost like a guest house. So a year in advance, and whether or not I was going to get the Fulbright, I could cancel that reservation. But that's what I ended up doing, and it was very reasonable. It's very, very reasonable. But I want you to know that Fulbright did ask me about that. The American Center, when I arrived, did I have a place already arranged? And yes, but they were ready to assist me in finding lodging. But that first week, they give you, a hotel or something like that until you have found that. In terms of shopping, I do a lot of walking. So most of what I could do was walk or take little auto rickshaws if necessary, but Uber, of course, I have Uber. But I made my purchases at a grocery store. I had access to a refrigerator. Of course, I had my own coffee, make my coffee, but you can get anything at the grocery store. And I mean, I went to movies by myself, frequented coffee shops, got to know the people in the city, had my places, went to the theater, movie. But I made myself busy. I only had Sundays off because nursing school is 6 days a week. So the only day off I had from work was Sunday, and I took full advantage of just getting out and enjoying going to museums, just getting out. So those are some things. But, you know, I don't know if in your case, but the lodging really has to be set up as soon as possible. I know that some of the other Fulbrighters, we were on an email listserv. They were having difficulty with that.
Okay, great. Well, we've just got a few minutes left, about 9 minutes left. So I'm going to thank you, Catherine, for all of that. I'm going to just proceed to the next slide and just kind of share quickly the opportunities available, because we've been getting some questions about priority topics or topics of interest to the commission in India. Do you have any insight, or would you like to share anything you know about what you felt? Because I know we spoke earlier and you did attend the mid-year conference in, where was it this time, this past
Delhi.
Delhi. Delhi, yes. So you attended that. That was put on by the Fulbright Commission. So if you could share, you know, and again, I do want to stress that the award is open to all disciplines, but if you could share any insight on that.
Sure. So some of the awardees were health care. So it was about teaching. So health care teaching in terms of programs, whether it be for lifestyle change, obesity in the schools, on that nature. There were mathematicians, so they were teaching math to high school students. Others, I would want to say I met dance. So they were going to schools to on that end. There were a lot of public health scholars were there, even one from San Diego State University who I got to know, and she was doing just health improvement. Let's see, archaeology, psychology. So there's just a whole gamut of literature. There was a gal that was assigned to a university in Goa, and her teaching grant was for 5 months and in the area of literature. So I could go on and on, but there was just a diverse, a variety that was just amazing. Environmental studies, I rode in a taxi from the airport to the conference, a gentleman that was working on environmental contamination and waterways. So you name it, there's many, many topics.
Right, and I do want to underscore that. So I've got the slide now open to the two All Disciplines Award, and really the first one here, the Fulbright Nehru Academic and Professional Excellence Award, is really the largest one in the catalog. So there are 45 grants available that. So 45 U.S. scholars or professionals are able to go every year on this award. It does have the flex option available. The grant is 4 to 9 months, and the flex option does have different parameters, I believe 4 to 6 months. This award is open to, you know, professionals, practitioners, so you may or may not have a PhD or a terminal degree. If you have questions about whether you're eligible, you can email me. I'll post my information. But certainly, I just want to underscore that really this award is open to one and all. Who are eligible, and you can affiliate with any appropriate institution. The Fulbright Commission in Delhi will you know, they want to see all proposals and they want to see all proposed affiliations. You're not required to provide a letter of invitation, but if you do have one, they will either confirm it or suggest another place if they feel that, A, there's been too many Fulbright scholars that have been going there and they'd really like to kind of spread the wealth to different institutions, maybe outside of the big metro cities, or B, there's a huge need for someone with your expertise elsewhere that perhaps you might not have known. So traditionally they do, they will, you know, confirm the proposed host institution that you have in your project, but just be aware that there is that small chance that they may say, look, you know, we could really use someone with your expertise over here. So that's written into the award description. The other award here is the Fulbright-Nehru Distinguished Chair Award. There are two spots in this award, and this is really geared towards applicants who are at least at the associate, if not full professor, even you know, towards the more senior scholars who have a long teaching record and very distinguished publication record. So I encourage, for those of you that might not fit directly into the Academic and Professional Excellence Award in terms of, you know, you might have your terminal degree and several years of experience in publications, so certainly the Distinguished Chair Award would be a good option for you. And then the other two opportunities, so new this year, and again, the deadline for this year is September 16th, and this would be for award opportunities in the 2020-2021 academic year. So starting as early as, well, typically fall, but I believe India does allow projects to start as early as July 2020. So we have the Fulbright Kalam Climate Fellowship, and this is a new opportunity that I'm really excited about. It's a 4 to 9 month grant. It is open to several disciplines, but they do prefer biological sciences, chemistry, engineering, environmental sciences, geology, or public and global health. And the goal of this award is to build long-term capacity to address the needs of climate change issues by really bringing scholars from the U.S. And India together to tackle these issues. They've had this award available to Indians to come to the U.S., and I'm happy that they're opening it for U.S. citizens to come to India. Specifically, in terms of preferred specializations, they're interested in people from atmospheric science, geochemistry, paleontology, oceanography, toxicology, hydrology and water management, et cetera. The list goes on, so please check the award description for more information. And then the regional research opportunity that's available is called the South and Central Asia Regional Research Program, and this is great for someone who has a research project that requires not only visiting India, but perhaps Nepal as well, or India and Sri Lanka. Et cetera, or, you know, India and Kazakhstan. So any country that is in the South and Central Asia region that's listed in the award description, and those eligible countries are there online, you can see, and if your project requires a country in addition or two countries in addition to India, please do explore that option. Let's go back to our questions and see if we had any other things that Catherine can answer here. So, Catherine, do you think that proposing a teaching and research combination was beneficial to you, or did you feel, because from my understanding, there's no real preference. The award is open to teaching only, research only, or a combination of both. But do you feel that your experience was a little more enhanced because you were doing both?
I do. And I'll speak to that personally because there was then an interest. We saw improvement in knowledge and self-confidence to then want to return to do that type of a program. So it totally is teaching, but you're taking what you've gathered and putting that into the research to inform others. So the combination was a good a good pick, and you know, there's a maybe a lack of knowledge in the area of diabetes prevention and management, at least in the area I was in. So again, the education piece was key, and then what to do with the information that you gathered to help inform and then move forward in further research.
Great. Now, we've just got a minute left, and I wanted to highlight the opportunities for grantees once they receive their grant and they're in country. So that's here on the slide. Catherine did attend the mid-year conference. There's also the regional travel grant available for short-term for a short-term visit within the region. And then last but not least, we did get a couple questions. Can I apply for the India Award as well as a different award? And you are only allowed to apply to one award per competition cycle. And the deadline this year is September 16th. And if you'd like to contact me, here is my contact. It's southcentralasia@iie.org. And I encourage all of you, if you haven't done so, to register with my Fulbright. Again, this PowerPoint will be available in a few days, probably early next week, on our website. And I know that we didn't get a chance to answer everyone's question. Please email me. I'd love to talk with you offline. We can set up a phone call kind of determine where you'd be a good fit and where you could be affiliated. So, Catherine, thank you so much for taking the time to join us out on the West Coast. And I thank everyone for joining us online for the webinar. Again, my name is Michelle Balorchi, and I manage the awards to South and Central Asia in terms of applications. So if you're interested and have some questions and you'd like to get some feedback and advice, feel free to contact me. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you too, Michelle. Bye-bye.